Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport by myself, Catherine Whittaker, and David Law. We are in separate climes this week. I in London, David in Solihull, and we have both enjoyed the fruits of Sloane Stephens and John Isner's labour to win their first ever Miami Open titles this Easter weekend and secure what at the moment, David, is a whitewash for the US of A in Miami. As we speak, the women's doubles title, the women's doubles final is taking place, and there is a chance for Coco Vandeweghe to get one last piece of glory for the United States. But as it stands at the moment, the Bryans have won the men's doubles, Sloane Stephens has won the women's, and John Isner has just beaten Sasha Zverev 6-7, 6-4, 6-4 to prove that 32 years of age really is one's peak. That's what I'm reading into it. Anyway, first ATP Masters 1000 title at the age of 32.
All I need now is for somebody to do something meaningful at the age of 44 just to make me feel better, and then all will be well.
Meaningful things are happening all the time by 44-year-olds, just perhaps not necessarily as athletic meaningful things.
No.
But yes, well done, John Isner. His first Masters 1000 title. He's never before won even a 500-level title. He's only won two ATP 250 titles before this. He rises to number 9 in the world. It's really quite something. And similarly, for Sloane Stephens, she beat Yelena Ostapenko 7-6, in fact, 6-1 in their final yesterday to prove that she's an all or nothing kind of gal, isn't she? She either wins huge titles or does absolutely nothing at all. She really keeps us tennis fans and commentators very much on our toes.
And actually, the title victories of Isner and Sloane Stephens versus their year to date couldn't be more similar. Because we'll go on to talk about Isner in a minute, but he's had a pretty rotten time of it this year.
One match win, I think.
I think he'd managed two. But, you know, you're talking an appalling record, really, so far this year for the man. And then he's come out and done this. But Sloane Stephens, since the US Open, she went on an 8-match losing streak straight after the US Open. Now, I was pretty critical of that, to be honest, throughout. Now, mainly because I felt as though her mind wasn't there. She has sort of hidden behind physical issues over the last few days and has certainly brought that up a number of times, that the mind was willing but the body wasn't. However, she did do an interview a couple of days ago on the court. I mean, she had a fantastic run to this title, by the way, because she beat Garbiñe Muguruza in the quarterfinals. She beat Angelique Kerber, and then she's beaten Victoria Azarenka just to get to the final before beating Yelena Ostapenko. So that is a seriously good run of wins for her. And that's after having found a way past Monica Niculescu. More of that in a moment. But the thing she said on court the other day, I think it was after beating Muguruza, is that what happened to me after the US Open was I had a good time. I mean, and it's now back to the day job. And that honestly, is how it felt a lot of the time. I'm sure she was struggling physically to some extent, but there is no coincidence that her best results come in the United States of America. By far, she has done so little outside of the US generally, and yet here she is in the space of 6 months. She's won the US Open title in New York. She'd had a good run in the rest of the summer as well last year, having come back after that 11-month layoff, and then she has this terrible run in Asia. She loses first round in the Australian Open. We weren't at all surprised that she lost first round in the Australian Open. And then she ends up winning this title, beating a succession of really high-caliber opponents. And she was brilliant, Sloane Stephens. She's a joy to watch when she can really be bothered to put everything into it and when everything is in sync. And I think part of it is a bad attitude sometimes, and part of it is just her general makeup. She is somebody who isn't going to be able to just punch the clock every single week. I just don't think that that is her. But I think to some degree we have to just take that and accept it, because the good stuff is so good that it's a joy to behold, because she doesn't just hit the ball hard. She has court craft. She maneuvers the ball around the court. She has spin. She has angles. And in the final against Ostapenko, I described it as if she was employing plan B before she bothered with plan A. And plan B was soak up everything that Ostapenko could throw at her and just effectively sort of rope-a-dope her way to victory by making a miss. And it was just a masterclass in defending and chasing balls down and making her play more and more balls. It was brilliant.
Yeah, she made Ostapenko look a wee bit one-dimensional, didn't she? Which is something. She's a blooming good one-dimensional player, but her way, in contrast to Stephens, her way of winning is blasting her way through opponents. There's no compromise with Ostapenko, but with Stephens, she can compromise, or it's not even compromise, because she does have, you know, beyond plan B, she has C, D and E, doesn't she? She has so much at her disposal, which I think provokes more backlash and more disappointment when she does have underperforming weeks, because her potential is so stark and so there for all to see that when she really brazenly underperforms, we all feel a bit cheated, really, because we so enjoy it when she does show up and is obviously up for playing tennis. But yeah, I agree with you. We're not all made of the same stuff, are we? And she's not going to be able to punch the clock week after week. We're never going to know which Sloane Stephens is going to show up. But there's definitely, without question, a far better chance of good Sloane showing up in the US of A than anywhere else in the world, that's for sure. And that is not, she's not unique in that respect. It's not necessarily the case with all US players, but I think more so than any other nation, they do have this propensity to post far better results at home, US players, than others do. Is that fair to say, do you think? She
said, only partially tongue-in-cheek to us on BT Sport, she was interviewed, and she said, well, why does this always happen? Why do I play my best stuff in the US? You know, it's just I get to eat the food that I want, and I've got reliable cell phone service, and the Wi-Fi is good, and things like that. Now, I think she was partially joking, but at the same time, these little home comforts are important to certain players, I think, and I think that when she went to Asia after the US Open, I mean, it seemed to me that there was a clear letdown of, oh, I've won the US Open. Do I have to do all this? I really could do without this. And she looked disinterested on the court. I know that she was physically struggling as well. So it's easy for me to say, isn't it? I'm not a professional tennis player feeling rubbish on the court. But that's how it came across to me. It came across disappointingly. But I can't give Nick Kyrgios a free pass all the time and not be able to apply the same to Sloane Stephens, who has actually won a Grand Slam title and has now backed it up by winning one of the biggest tournaments in the world 6 months later. So she is producing. I think the other thing that was interesting is, I mentioned Monica Niculescu. This could have all unraveled dramatically in the second match she played at this tournament, Stevens, because she was a set down. She lost the first set on a tiebreak. The second set, she was at 3-3 against Niculescu, who was just driving her crazy. And Stevens, credit to her, admitted this. She said, you know, this tournament is not won by brilliant performances against Garbiñe Muguruza, because they would not matter unless I was able to fight my way through against Monica Niculescu, who's slicing and dicing me all the way to Beijing. Those were her words on an outside court, and she managed to win that match. And that was huge. That was huge for Stevens, because, and I think it is for this type of mercurial player, for them to show that application when they really need it. And, you know, all credit to her. Just a quick word as well on Ostapenko. She'd had a similarly disappointing year so far this year. It was fascinating to see her work with David Taylor, the Australian coach, who was really trying to keep her upbeat and getting her to go for her shots and sort of freeing up her mind, I felt, and trying to stop her worrying about doing anything other than going after her shots. And I suspect that there are going to be some more big results coming Ostapenko's way.
And there are parallels also with what you're saying about Sloane Stephens there. John Isner also lost a 6-1 set in his opening match in Miami against Jiří Veselý. And it's a bit of a cliche to say it, but the parallels are absolutely there. That's, you know, that's as much where the title was won and lost for him as it was in the second and third sets against Sasha Zverev today. Is there anybody before we move on to talk about that in more detail, David? I perhaps thought you might want to touch upon young Danielle Collins a wee bit before we talk about the chaps.
Well, she's an interesting story. I mean, a word as well on Victoria Azarenka, who reached the semis and looked very good doing so. But Danielle Collins is somebody that I imagine a fair few listeners haven't heard about before, and I saw her for the first time last year, I think, in Indian Wells. She managed to have one match, which she lost, and I read up about her at that time. She'd come through the college system, basically gone to Virginia University, decided that she was going to study media studies and get a whole degree behind her rather than taking a wild card into the US Open, which would have guaranteed her $35,000 at the time, because the scholarship she got to that university was worth $50,000 every year for the years that she studied that. And she decided, I want that behind me. And it's fascinating to hear her talk this week about how that has sort of freed her mind up in the really tight moments. It makes her not worry so much, because she feels almost as though there's not quite as much on it. You know, that if I lose this match, yeah, it's a shame, but I've got a degree. I'm you know, if all tennis doesn't work out, I've got this behind me. I'll get a good job. It's fine. And she's 24, but she's got that sort of mental maturity out there of a player. Maturity is perhaps not the right word. It's the sort of enthusiasm of somebody who's 17, because this is all new to her, the circuit, and my goodness, she can play the game, absolutely world class backhand from what I can see, and she beat Venus Williams along the way. She'd had a decent run to the fourth round in Indian Wells, and here she goes and beats Venus on her way to the semis. So it's a fantastic run. She more than doubled her prize money for her whole career in 1 week. She won over $300,000 last week, and I would be surprised if we don't see a lot more of her in the future. And I just think it's nice to see a player who couldn't afford the fancy academies when she was young. She had working class parents. She managed to get a scholarship to university. And now she's starting to make it as a tennis player. Good for her.
And Victoria Azarenka back inside the top 100. Some great performances. But ultimately, am I being harsh, David, in saying a bit disappointing against Sloane Stephens?
I think you are a bit. Only in as much as I think she ran out of gas, to be honest.
But is that not in itself a bit disappointing? I don't know.
I think it's to be expected, okay, for somebody who just hasn't played very much recently. Yeah. I think she hasn't built that match toughness, you know, that hardened herself to the rigours of it all. And she also got really wound up on the court. I think she started to feel it going, a little. I mean, she ended up losing about 10 games in a row, and she got wound up by the crowd. She went sort of head-to-head with them, and I think she just burnt herself out in the match a bit, to be honest.
Yeah. Where will we see her next? We still don't know, do we?
That's a big question mark.
It's very difficult to talk about. Usually, you know, we talk about these players in terms of an arc, don't we? Their narrative playing arc. It's not just about their result in a vacuum. It's about the context of it in respect to the past and the future. What does this mean for the future? That's what we do as a podcast, isn't it? And I don't know what any of it means for Victoria Azarenka's future. I don't know if we'll ever see her play. You know, it's not inconceivable that that's kind of it. And I don't know how on earth she gets herself not motivated. You can still see she still loves the sport and is in great shape and everything, but we know that this is a game of absolutely tiny margins. Even if you're fantastically talented and have all the gifts and everything, the margins are absolutely tiny. So not that uncertainty of not knowing when she'll be able to compete again, when she'll be able to get ranking points again, all of it. I don't know how she deals with it. Will we see her on clay at all? I don't know. I mean, it's pretty much all in Europe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, there's Charleston, but will we see her during the clay court swing? I don't know.
Very, very good question, and I agree with you. I mean, first of all, I think she has got herself in the most incredible physical shape for somebody who hasn't been able to play the sport. She's obviously just been in the gym a heck of a lot and training really, really hard. I thought the fact that she managed to get her level to this point would suggest that she could, as long as she can stay fit, she can pretty much turn it on and off, because her level was amazing for somebody who just hasn't been playing matches. You know, we've seen how difficult it has been for Novak Djokovic and for Serena Williams to come back and immediately reach the levels to which we're accustomed. But you're right, I mean, it's in her mind, how does she reconcile the fact that she is a top tennis player at the peak of her powers in so many ways, who is not really going to be able to play tennis until she sorts out this custody situation with her estranged partner, who basically is not letting her leave California according to the rules of the custody situation with her son, and she doesn't want to be away from her son, which, you know, you can completely understand. So it's a pretty difficult situation for her. I mean, I hope she gets it sorted, because she's still got so much to offer. I mean, just 28 and playing tennis like that.
She's back in the top 100, which, you know, all other things being equal, will help. And she's certainly, you know, she's still going to get, if she's able to play, she'll get wild cards, you know, pretty much wherever she wants. But Sloane Stephens is back in. She's inside the top 10, not back inside the top 10. She's in the top 10 for the first time. John Isner also, they've both risen to number 9 in the world, David. And this is fresh in our minds because it's happened less than an hour ago. John Isner winning his first ever Masters title, age 32. I know I keep saying it, but it's quite something, isn't it, that he's... I know in terms of the Roger Federer canister, he's maybe not quite a 32-year-old in the way we think of 32-year-old tennis players, because he started a bit later. He went through the college system as well, so similarities with Daniel Collins there. And a number of the US players now, Steve Johnson went through the college system, didn't he? But still, 32, to win your first Masters title, to genuinely be talking, even at the beginning of the year when things were, as we've been saying, woeful for him, he still had this sort of... something in his voice and something about the way he was saying that he genuinely believed his best tennis was still ahead of him. He obviously knew something that we didn't he? He genuinely did seem to know that this was in him. Special praise, by the way, should also definitely go to David McPherson, his Australian coach, who also has been coaching the Bryan brothers. So he has sort of won 3 titles this week, David McPherson. Yes. Do you think they should make him some kind of honorary trophy of some sort, or just throw him a big party and a cake? He should definitely get a cake.
I can't think of too many people, if anybody, has ever done the sort of the coaching double at a tournament like that, at a tournament of this level. I mean, what an amazing achievement.
Now, I remember who was it, James Blake and Marty Fish, or was it? It was definitely Marty Fish and another American player that were being coached by the same guy. Was it Marty Fish and Sam Querrey? Was it Sam Querrey and someone? Was it Sam Querrey and someone else? It was David Nankin was the coach.
Yes, that
it was
about,
Sam
yeah.
Querrey, and it was another American.
Yeah, I think it might have been Marty Fish. But
Marty
anyway,
Fish, yeah. Anyway, but they're still not the same.
Just a word on John Isner age-wise. I mean, you talk about him being 32. There's a couple of things. I mean, he did actually, you know, the first time I ever really remember seeing him play tennis was 11 years ago at the US Open, and he played Roger Federer, and he won the first set. And Federer was all-conquering at that time, of course, and Isner won the first set against him. So you're talking 11 years ago when he was just 21. So he wasn't that old when he started. And I also think, and I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody who's fairly freakishly tall, and I know how many aches and pains I have when I wake up.
Tallest guy ever to win a Masters 1000 title, David.
Yeah, well, him, not me.
But that means that if you won one, that title's gone now.
Well, it is, because to put it into perspective, I'm 6'7", and when he comes up to me, I feel so intimidated and inferior, and I hate it. Oh, it's so annoying.
You hate it.
I mean, it is my thing. Being tall is what I do well.
It's
right?
A weird thing about tall people, isn't it? My brother is like that around you, because he's used to being the tallest guy in the room. Yeah, and he doesn't like that you're an inch taller than him. He doesn't like it.
It's just a bit, you know, don't like this. But, you know, he has to be the only person that I've ever seen on court thank his chiropractor. And I mean, you know, you can imagine it. Just imagine how long it takes to sort of roll his body out of bed and kind of iron it out.
Being that tall is in many respects a sort of physical disability, isn't it? I mean, No, I said that tall. I didn't say tall in general. I'm talking 6'9", 6'10" plus, which is what he is. I mean, how. There must be some days where just everything hurts. I know that's the life of a professional athlete, but yeah, it's staggering. We've probably talked about this before on the podcast, haven't we? But the fact, referring back to the sort of tall people not liking other tall people, when John Isner came on the scene, so Ivo Karlovic was the tallest sheriff in town, and he was supposedly 6'10", and then John Isner came along and said, "I'm 6'10". So mysteriously, Ivo Karlovic's height the next year in the ATP media guide was 6'11".
Yes. Quite right. And actually, he Isner and Riley Opelka have done a little photo shoot next to one another to find out who's tallest. It's pretty even, but Karlovic appears to just about have it. Just go on.
Well, I was just going to say, what do we think now for John Isner? I mean, obviously, the fact that clay lies in wait is not ideal for him. So it's not, you know, the perfect test set of conditions in terms of what he can use this win to propel him to. But all other things being equal, what is this, a lovely, wonderful moment in his career, sort of potentially in isolation, and he'll continue to be a top 20-25 player? Or is it not too late for this to propel him to being a Grand Slam contender? He's barely ever really done anything at Grand Slam level before. I think it's fair to say, some may find this harsh, but I think I've said it on the podcast before, that in terms of Grand Slam performances, he has disappointed throughout his career.
I think for one of the most intelligent, educated people on the circuit, I think some of his scheduling for himself has just been head-scratchingly bad.
Team-esque.
Not that bad, but almost worse in a way, because
he's the benchmark.
He hasn't played as relentlessly as team, but you look at some of his choices as to when to play, and I've lost count of the amount of times he's just completely tired himself out ahead of, for instance, the US Open, which is the one he has the best chance of winning. And I just don't. Why would you take that much out of your canister?
He always plays Winston-Salem, doesn't he?
Yeah,
always. I'm sure that's a great event, but you're absolutely right. That is the one he has the most chance of winning. It is not an accident that most Grand Slam contenders don't play on the men's side the week before a Grand Slam. That's not a coincidence. That's not an accident.
But I would say he does have a chance, you know, because particularly now.
Yeah.
And the reason I say, look.
But you know, I think it points to the fact that maybe he didn't think of himself in that way before now, but he ought to have. But maybe
possibly,
this will change things for him.
I think the bigger point is that he's always run into Andy Murray or Novak Djokovic or Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer. And you know,
welcome to being a tennis player in this era.
That's... He is one of the few that can worry any of those guys on his day because his game is so big he can take the racket out of an opponent's hand. We saw it tonight against Zverev, who had won the first set today, and Isner came back firing and broke the Zverev game down. We'll come on to talk about Zverev in a moment. But just about Isner, in this era where you don't have a Djokovic at his peak, maybe that'll come back. You don't even have an Andy Murray on the scene. Rafael Nadal's injury record of late has been pretty poor the last 6 months. And Roger Federer, I mean, yes, he's been amazing, but he is 37 in August. You know, there is a window here. The problem is, can John Isner get himself playing this sort of tennis when he needs to at a slam?
Well,
that's the question.
For me, if I were John Isner, that would be my absolute number. That would be my raison d'etre. That would be the only thing that mattered to me. How can I make sure I'm playing this tennis, if not better, in New York this year? You know, to screw the rest of the year. Irrelevant. I've won a Masters 1000 now. I know that for that to be the case, it will require playing, you know, the right warm-up events, et cetera, et cetera. But that has to be everything to John Isner now. It has to be an all-consuming thought.
Yeah.
Will it be? I don't know. I mean, logically, he should consider Wimbledon in the same bracket, shouldn't he? Grass, et cetera, et cetera. But for some reason, I think movement-wise on the grass, getting low. I know that his serve has great penetration on the grass, but this, I don't know. He's won
Newport three times.
I mean, I know it's
not quite the same level. He's won 12 titles overall, but he has won that. But I agree with you. I mean, he is almost too tall, really, to play and be as successful on grass.
Yeah,
but then
there's
the
a law
time,
of diminishing returns with
and he,
height
and, he's
and
quite,
serve
he is
and
quite
grass,
good on
there?
Clay. Do you remember him? I think he took Nadal five sets on clay a few years ago when Nadal ended up winning the title, one of his 10. And that was at the French. So, you know, he's one of those players that people do not want to run into in a quarterfinal, one of the big five. They don't want to be anywhere near him, I think.
What do we think about Sasha Zverev, Alex Zverev, David, and his performance in this final and his quite glorious racket smash, which I know you'll want to touch upon?
That was amazing.
It was after he lost serve, wasn't it, to leave John Isner serving for the match
in the third set. So far up in my estimation when he does that, because
it's a great old racket smash.
It was a classic
of the genre.
Yeah, it's done with such sort of pent up frustration that he's held it in for the whole 2 hours. And
held it in for the whole 2 hours,
of,
David?
Yes. I mean, you know,
not really. He was pretty frustrated when he lost serve at the end of the second.
Yeah, pretty frustrated. But that was a proper smash. And then he did another one straight afterwards just for good measure. So I did quite enjoy that, very much so. But I mean, you know, the thing with Zverev, I feel a bit conflicted talking about him because I still feel like he's not delivering on his potential, and that seems just outrageously unfair for somebody who's achieved so far a lot more like for like than Nick Kyrgios at a younger age, and he's achieved more than all of these other young players, really, apart from maybe you could say Edmund, now that Edmund's made a semi at a slam. But do you know what I mean? I don't quite understand what it's not. I don't feel like I'm being fair to him, but the hype tells me he's supposed to be dominating, isn't it?
Life is feels, and it feels like he's underachieving somehow. Not in a dramatic way. I mean, obviously, this is a great result, but you know, he won't be happy with this. He's going to be, you know, look at his face during that trophy presentation, he said all the right things, credit to him, but it was obviously killing him standing up there with the runners-up plate. That really hurt him today. He feels like he should have won that match. I don't want to do any disservice at all to John Isner, but there were moments when it felt like it was on Zverev's racket, and his nerve cost him in a way that it didn't cost Isner. Isner's nerve held up, I thought, in a way that Zverev's didn't quite. I like to see Zverev nervous. I have to say, it reassures me that he's not too cocky and he's not yes. too much taking it for granted. I like to see a nervous Alex Zverev, and boy, did we see that today. I think the nerves really did cost him. He probably should have broken back when Isner was serving 5-4 in the second set. He had a couple of chances, I think, and at least one of those, I think he had a backhand pass, which ordinarily he definitely would have made. And Isner stood up to the examination in a way that he didn't. And in the end, his forehand broke down, didn't it? And I don't know. You're right. We are on paper being unfair to him, but if we're being unfair to him, then it's nothing compared to how he'll be being with himself.
I agree with you about the nerves. I also warm to him that he was so disappointed. I like to see that. I think that
definitely
bodes well for his future. I've got a question for you. How much do you like watching him play? Do you know, if you put him up against the others in that sort of bracket, where does he come?
What do you mean by the age bracket or style bracket?
Age bracket, that sort of
in group. Terms of style of play, it's not. I mean, each to their own. There are plenty of people for whom that is an enjoyable style of play. For me personally, and I think very generally speaking, you know, if you're gonna talk about all the things that we praise Roger Federer for in terms of style of play, he's a bit of an antithesis to that. He's fantastically talented, he has glorious timing, but aesthetically those things are less ostentatiously pleasing than are, you know, the more Federer-esque skills. It's not my favorite style of play. I like him. I like his I like his frailties at the moment. I could imagine becoming, if he did become, you know, a metronomic, all dominating, winning everything type player, I could imagine becoming bored with that. But then I usually do become bored with people that win everything. I like competition more than I like tennis. I like to see a good match more than I like to see beautiful tennis. So
you didn't like Federer, did you, that much when we first met in 2007? You weren't into that.
No, it was too, I couldn't relate to it. He was too good, and it seemed too easy. Now I know that's ridiculous, but it seemed too easy. It felt too uncompetitive. I enjoy watching competition. I'd rather watch two players ranked 400 in the world battling it out than I would want to watch the number one in the world playing divine tennis to beat someone 11-1. But we're getting away from the point here, because I think what you're getting at is that, very broadly speaking, notwithstanding people's more niche preferences, it is not the most objectively pleasing style of play, is it? I'm being a bit mealy-mouthed about it to try and not... You know what I'm getting at.
Look, I got into trouble the other day when I was watching Denis Shapovalov against Borna Coric, and I tweeted, if you don't enjoy watching Denis Shapovalov play tennis, I suspect you don't like tennis. And I got absolutely hammered from certain quarters. Now,
from people that didn't enjoy watching Denis Shapovalov play tennis?
No, I think most of it was...
Maniacs.
No, I don't think it was that. I think it was, you know, what you're really saying is don't think anybody likes tennis who doesn't like the same thing as you like.
For goodness sake, this is why therein lies my issue with pole vault, that people like that get a vote. I mean, look, as I say, if we're prepared to to make blanket statements the way we do about Roger Federer and that sort of style of play, then there is a reverse side to that coin, isn't there? We're accepting that there are more and less pleasing styles of play. You know, we talk about Federer being a magician, etc., etc. There are certain, yeah.
No, yeah. I look, I'm with you. But the other thing I wanted to say, I keep trying to really, really like Alexander Zverev's style of play. I keep thinking, come on, you know, get into this. Let's see what this is all about. But I'm not moved by it, really. On the whole, there are occasions where I have been. I think what he did at the Davis Cup was just exceptional at the start of this year, helping to beat Australia. There have been moments when he's played against Kyrgios, when he's come back at him during a match and got in really animated, and I've loved watching that as well. But style of play-wise, no, I'm not excited by Zverev at this point, certainly not compared to somebody like Kyrgios or Shapovalov. It's just a personal preference. The other big question here, rumours went bonkers a couple of days ago because Ivan Lendl was in Miami when I think Zverev was playing. I don't mean he wasn't in his box or anything like that, but it did get everybody talking.
Lendl basically lives in Miami.
Yeah, I know. But just imagine what that has got to be on paper, the perfect combination, hasn't it? This guy with just seemingly unlimited potential, who's yet to even go beyond the fourth round of a Grand Slam. He hasn't reached a quarterfinal. He, from what the coaches say, he has some sort of issue with his forehand that is not producing the goods. And you've got this guy, Ivan Lendl, who had one of the great forehands, who had an issue with getting over the line. He did it with his own career. He helped Andy Murray get over his hump in his career. What an amazing alliance that would be, particularly with Jez Green, who was part of that team as well in the group that looks after Zverev. I mean, that would be a formidable pairing, I think, don't you?
Yep, sold, David, sold. You've completely sold me on it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Talking of coaching alliances, Novak Djokovic and Andre Agassi are no more.
I know, and it was the news was, I mean, it's always been pretty loose in the sense that, you know, there are some coaching relationships where if the coach is absent from the box on one occasion, your questions will instantly be asked. Whereas you know, if Agassi wasn't there, you wouldn't instantly think, oh, well, what's going on here? It was definitely seemed like a more relaxed part-time arrangement than even some of the other super coaching partnerships. But it was actually Agassi that confirmed in an interview to ESPN that they had gone their separate ways, and that it was because that it was Agassi, or certainly his side of the story, is that he made the final decision. It was because they found themselves agreeing to disagree more often than not, which is, we're in speculation town, aren't we? But it's pretty interesting in broadly inside. I mean, it just makes you want to know so much more, doesn't it? It just makes you want to have been a fly on the wall in every coaching related discussion they ever had. But
yeah, it's
a wonderful glimpse, but it's just not enough. It just makes you want to know all the things that we'll probably never know.
And it's probably the second thing that I've been slightly surprised that Agassi has done as part of that relationship over the course of the last 10 minutes. The first was to say that I'm here on my own dime, which I thought was a slightly surprising thing to put out there, that I'm not being paid at the time. The second one is for him to effectively announce the end of this relationship without an official announcement from Novak Djokovic. You know, these things tend to happen as a mutually agreed separation, don't they?
That's yeah. When were we talking about it the other day about how sicklily saccharine and mutually agreed and all these coaching partnerships seem to split up in a Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow-esque conscious uncoupling,
yes,
kind of a way that just makes you want to be sick.
Yes, but the fact is, I mean, you're right, that I have to say, give you some credit here, because you were always skeptical about that combination, and you never thought that was real, to be honest, did you? Now, I think the intentions were genuine, but I mean, you weren't quite as on the ball as Goran Ivanišević, who I think told you, didn't he, at the French Open, this is not going to last. And actually, it's probably lasted longer than expected, except that there's a massive great big hole of inactivity in there as well, when they probably weren't doing a whole lot together. So, you know,
it's not that I thought it was fake. I just thought it was flimsy. And I don't know, I didn't quite see the mesh in quite the same way. I don't think it was all for show or anything. They certainly did work together in some capacity. Maybe there's a world in which there is something that Andre Agassi could bring to Djokovic, and he's just not in the right place mentally,
yes,
for that to work.
I think game-wise, mentally,
I think that is certainly a possibility.
Well, remember when Lendl and Murray split for the second time, really, I think the view was, well, what's the point in having a super coach when you're not a player? Because at that point, Andy Murray wasn't playing any tennis. No point.
Yeah,
in
but Djokovic
is
a player.
I know, but hardly. You know, this is not the Novak Djokovic.
Well, exactly.
We're used to.
I mean, it sounds awful to say, but you're right. Yeah,
he's an afterthought at the moment, because he's not relevant to the conversation. I mean, he's relevant in terms of his all-time greatness. He is one of the all-time greats, is Novak Djokovic. But at the moment, he is not relevant on this scene, because he can't win matches.
And maybe, you know, there's a difference. And you could say, well, that's where Andre Agassi was for a while. He dipped down to challenger level, didn't he? And managed to come back and be
maybe
a Grand Slam winner.
Maybe,
but
that's what he wanted to get across.
I don't know.
To him.
There's historically, and Lendl and Murray and Becker and Djokovic are probably the best examples for this. The super coaches, partly, I guess, because of the limited time generally that they're able to devote, they want to be the marginal gain, don't they? They want to get you over the last bit of the line to glory. They don't want to be doing, you know, the lion's share of the work. They want to be doing that crucial, intangible last bit of the work that is completely invaluable. They don't want to be doing the day-to-day grind of making you a relevant tennis player, which is, I guess, what Radek Stepanek is doing with Novak Djokovic just at the moment. And again, I want to be a fly on the wall. why can't they all be mic'd up all of the time and be followed round by GoPros? It's not fair. It's not fair that we only have to speculate. I want to know so much more.
Yes, me too. Oh, it's intriguing.
But you're right, though. It's interesting. That, and again, you know, as much as Becker and Djokovic, the announcement of that split a year or so ago, what was in control of the Djokovic camp, and it was all very amicable and so on at the time. Becker did then a bit break ranks with the Sky interview that he gave, where he questioned Djokovic's work ethic in the months leading up to the split. That was a bit sort of unexpected in terms of the general course of a breakup and how little we end up hearing about the nitty gritty of it. And again, this is one that's got away from the Djokovic media PR machine, and I doubt they're very happy about that.
No, I dare say you're right. Oh, it's fascinating. Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to just see what those two go on to do, both Djokovic on the court and Agassi, whether he has another re-entry into the sport, whether it's given him a taste for it. Because, I mean, we've seen some players come onto the scene. Think of Martina Navratilova, who had her brief coaching assignment with Agnieszka Radwańska. I know she was really keen to do some coaching. It didn't work out, didn't last long, and we've not seen her do any since then.
Yeah, and I struggle to believe that she... I know it would have to be the right person and the right price and all of those things, but I struggle to believe that there isn't somebody out there that could make it work and wouldn't hugely benefit from Martina Navratilova as a coach. I find it staggering that there are these coaches that are on the shelf. You'd expect them to be so highly in demand, wouldn't you? But... yeah, but we're in a super culture lull phase. What, yeah. David? Final question for you. It's a big one, so prepare yourself. It's a very broad, wide ranging question. What's going to happen on the clay?
Oh, that is so interesting because Roger Federer is not playing it. Rafael Nadal is coming back onto it. A few pictures of him in training. He looks like he's starting to get going again. Juan Martín Del Potro has been in amazing form of late. I think it was something like 15 or 16 match wins in a row before he lost out to Isner in the semis there. And yet he's sort of talking Del Potro as if he's going to have a bit of time off now and rest his body and maybe not play that much on clay. And I have to say, I think that would be sensible, really. He's going to have to manage his body quite carefully. What's going to happen?
But I don't disagree with you, but equally, with Nadal an unknown quantity for clay, and that, I mean, that may only be the case for a matter of days or weeks. You know, it might be that he comes out and plays Monte Carlo and is in absolutely beast-like form and we all go, okay, he's going to win the French Open for an 11th time. But as it stands at the moment, he's an unknown quantity and there is no natural, you know, that leaves an enormous Grand Slam door open, which I can't believe wouldn't feel tantalising for Del Potro. But, yeah. you know, you were right in what you say, but I can't believe that he wouldn't feel like, wow, I've got a big chance here. Anyway.
Yeah, I personally think Nadal is going to come out in beast-like form and be okay because I think he'll have had so much time off to get fresh. He'll have sorted this injury out, and I think he'll go bananas on the clay as usual and watch out everybody. But
who, as it stands at the moment, I'm asking all the big questions now, is second favourite for the men's French Open title? Da da da.
I would say
so if you can't tell, I've genuinely put David on the spot here. This is off the top of my head line of questioning. I genuinely want to know.
Normally I would say Dominic Thiem, but I know he's been injured of late. I think he's got the next most natural game for it.
Can you imagine what he's like having been unable to play tennis?
Might do in the world a good.
He might just be rocking back and forth in a dark room.
I mean, then there's Zverev, who does seem to be quite consistent at producing results.
No, but you can't just list good tennis players, David. Want to know,
I think,
if you were an odds compiler, who would be your second
favourite? I think the final, if the draw works out like this, is going to be Nadal against Thiem.
Okay. And on the women's, equally, if not more interesting, we've got Serena Williams on the comeback trail going into her least favourite surface. We've got Yelena Ostapenko, French Open champion, who has a lot of, is going to have a lot of pressure on her shoulder, but has done a lot to alleviate that pressure by reaching the final in Miami, I think. Had she gone into this clay swing, not having had that result, just having had the poor run of results that she had previous to Miami this year, she could have been feeling it. But then again, does Yelena Ostapenko feel pressure ever? I don't know.
I think she does if people start getting the ball back. I don't think it's sort of ahead of matches that she gets nervous. I think it's when it starts coming back. That's why Stevens was so good, I thought, that she just kept making
her
play.
Yeah, but that's tennis pressure rather than like emotional.
Yeah,
and
I'm not
pressure.
So sure she'll have that the emotional and mental pressure, really. I think she enjoys it. I think she enjoys playing. I don't think she gets too wound up. Shall I tell you who's
favourite for the women's French Open title then?
Well, Simona Halep for me. She's the best clay court player in the world. And so I'd go with her. I would say your other two, if the draws work out, I would put Stevens in the semis as well. I think she can be an excellent clay court player. And I would put Elena Svitolina in there. Serena Williams, I just think it's just it's likely to be too early for her to be dominating on clay. But I do think by the time we get on the grass, if she's had enough matches on the clay, she's the favourite for Wimbledon. I'd go probably with those three, and Muguruza would be the safe ones for the semis for me. But I think Simona Halep will win the French this year.
Ooh, I got a prediction out of him. I'm going to have to do more putting David Law on the spot.
What are you going
for
then?
I agree with you about Halep. Don't know about team. I worry for the fact that he's not been able to play much tennis. We haven't had an update on his knee, had we?
So who's going to win them both then?
Halep and Nadal. Goodness me, that's boring, isn't it?
Especially after
I've
just said that.
That's a boring, boring prediction. Sorry, everyone.
don't worry, folks. That'll all change over the next 6 weeks. It'll all change.
You'll be pleased to know, though, that next week you will be spared our boring predictions. I don't because did we make any predictions? Because David has grown completely fed up with the apocalypse-style weather that we're experiencing this spring in the UK, and is bobbing off on holiday, aren't you, David?
Oh yes.
So you will be treated not to terrible predictions next week. You will be treated to our third Ask David and Catherine special, which we recorded a couple of days ago. And it's good, isn't it, David? It's good.
Not that we're blowing our own trumpet, but absolutely.
No,
it's amazing.
It's all right.
It's amazing. It's all right. It's awesome.
In it, David, I compare you to Monica Niculescu. You don't, but you accepted it. You took it on the chin. There you go, little preview.
You're going to love it, folks. I tell you, there's so much scope for us to be embarrassed. You'll love it.
Yeah, it's a good one. So that will be out in a week's time, and then we'll be back a week after that to bring you another one of these with lots of terrible, terrible predictions and useless speculation about all the conversations that we don't get to hear because players aren't mic'd up all the time and don't carry around GoPros. If I was president of tennis, then that's what would happen. We have been, David, unless you have anything else to add.
No, I'm fine, thanks. Far away.
We have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport, with our three executive producers, Triple S, Melanie Bowes and TennisBalls.com, and with La Manga, who, as I always say, are still offering their 10% discount to all Tennis Podcast listeners on accommodation and on their tennis packages. TPodcast18 is the code to enter upon booking. Go to their website, lamanga.com. And of course, Charlie the Ferret is still our official Tennis Podcast mascot. We'll speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.